Brandon. All right, please be seated. Good morning. We have a full courtroom today. It's nice to have you all here. We are here on the case 2023 AP 2020, Governor Evers versus Senator Markline. Before we begin that, I want to acknowledge South Milwaukee High School is here today. If you could please stand so we can properly say hello. Wow, that's excellent. So you have a teacher that's related to a justice that's to my left. Jim Grossel, where are you? Oh, you're hiding. Nice to have you here today. Welcome. It's great to have you all here today after we're done with oral argument this morning. Surprisingly, Justice Rebecca Bradley will be meeting with you to answer any possible questions you might have, not talk about the case, but anything else. So try to think up some good ones because she likes to be challenged, and that'll make me happy if you can stump her. Okay, go ahead and have a seat. Let's start with the appearances, please, in the Evers-Markline case. All right, so the lineup I have is 12 minutes, followed by 13 minutes, 30 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes. You're not arguing. Okay, you're just company at the table. Got it. All right, perfect.
Good for you.
We all need it. Look at us. Okay, with that, let's get started on the case. Your arguments, please.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. First, a brief logistical matter. We'll be splitting our time by topic. My co-counsel, Ms. Dealey, will be addressing bicameralism and presentment, and I'll be addressing the executive power theory. I think one basic question resolves the executive power side of this case. Under our Constitution, may the same persons who have the power to make the law also have in their hands the power to execute the law. Put more simply, may the legislative branch both make the law and then control its execution? Of course not. That is one of the primary threats to individual liberty against which our separation of powers guards. And the legislative vetoes at issue here today collapsed legislative and executive power in exactly that dangerous way, which is why courts nationwide have been virtually unanimous in rejecting them.
Counsel, I've got a quick question for you. Are you arguing that all legislative vetoes violate the separation of powers, or just the veto at issue here?
We believe that the rules that we are asking this court to adopt will extend more broadly than the two legislative vetoes at issue here. This case does just challenge two, but again, the rules we're adopting, I believe, will invalidate many, if not most, legislative committee vetoes that are on the books, yes.
And I logical extension of your argument, counsel, that if the legislature cannot delegate its power to a legislative committee, it also cannot delegate its core legislative power to administrative agencies. Doesn't your argument jeopardize the entire administrative state in the state of Wisconsin?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason why is I point you to the SEIU decision in paragraphs 130 and 131. And there, Justice Kelly was explaining why when the executive agencies act, they are primarily exercising executive authority. And so when the legislature enacts a statute like Knowles-Nelson, it is not in any sense delegating legislative power to the executive branch to act. I mean, this is classic separation of powers theory. The legislature creates the law, sets out statutory criteria that the executive branch shall use when implementing the law. It might appropriate money, but once it does so, it's done. It is not when the executive then implements that law It's carrying out executive power. That is not a delegated legislative power when the executive acts. To be sure, the executive does need an authorizing statute to act, but when it then implements the statute, as DNR does here in the Knowles-Nelson context, that is executive power. That is not legislative power.
But it is legislative power when the executive is essentially enacting, adopting rules that have the force of law. That is lawmaking, is it not, counsel?
Well, we would disagree with that proposition. However, this court has not taken up the rulemaking vetoes in this case. But I do think the rulemaking issue is different from what we have here today. If you look at the Knowles-Nelson program that's at issue, and frankly, the vast majority of the veto provisions that the legislature has created and given to committees like the Joint Committee on Finance, they're not about rulemaking. They are about statutes that involve the legislature empowering the executive to act and apply the law to individual circumstances, not set general rules of prospective conduct, which is arguably what's at issue with rulemaking. That's not what's going on here. These statutes are core executive activity where the executive branch, DNR in this instance, looks at the statutory criteria that the legislature has enacted and decides, using executive discretion, which again is a quintessential executive act, how do I use the discretion granted to me by the legislature, and decides what projects are best to spend the state's money on, again, according to the criteria that the legislature has selected. And there are many of them if you look at the statutes.
Your briefing relies extensively on my dissents on the non-delegation doctrine, which are not the majority position of this court. It seems that you are asking the court to revive the non-delegation doctrine, but only to the extent that it supports or aggrandizes executive power. But in the past, the governor has taken the position that it's okay for the legislature to hand its power over to the executive branch. It seems that there's been a shift in the governor's position.
Well, I disagree with that respectfully, Your Honor. I think we've cited some of your concurring opinions simply for the principle that bicameralism and presentment is a critical aspect of enacting laws, and my co-counsel will address that in more detail. But I do think we've cited many cases, not simply decided by opinions by Your Honor, but you and other justices that have set out really the fundamental separation of powers principles that govern in Wisconsin. And they, on this point, are not meaningfully different from those in other states. I mean, this is bedrock.
I think you're asking us to alter our doctrine in the state of Wisconsin, but again, only to the extent that it would enhance executive power. If we're going to apply a strict separation of powers doctrine, which I've written on extensively, as have other justices, and the United States Supreme Court has also signaled perhaps a revival of the non-delegation doctrine in the future, doesn't that have to extend when we're looking at the exercise of powers by all branches of government? And if we're really going to look at this strictly, and I think that that's what your position is, I mean, you're asking us to change decades of cases that have blessed this committee review process statutorily. It was signed into law, actually, by the governor years ago. You're asking us to make a big shift. If we're going to make that shift, isn't it unwise to do that in a vacuum where, again, we're enhancing executive power, but we're not signaling to the legislature that it must also then curtail or claw back its core legislative power rather than making these broad legislative pronouncements and then leaving it to the executive to essentially make the law when it comes down to the tough details that the legislature has been criticized? I'm not just talking about our Wisconsin legislature, but Congress as well has been criticized for political reasons, leaving it to the executive branch so that agency officials and bureaucrats make these decisions without Congress or, in this case, the Wisconsin legislature having to take the political heat for those political decisions.
I disagree with the premise that what we're asking for is a significant shift in separation of powers doctrine. Again, I think if you look at our cases, for instance, the Gabler decision was very clear that when We look at core constitutional powers. We look at the constitutional text, and we examine where the constitutional text places a particular power. And it's very clear, I think, from this court's recent decisions that the power to execute the law is a core executive power that the legislature
But you would concede there's nothing in the Wisconsin Constitution that suggests that the legislature giving its power away to an executive branch agency is in any way.
I mean, again, Your Honor, I disagree with the premise of the question. I don't think that what's happening in any of the vetoes at issue here, especially the Knowles-Nelson veto, I mean, if you look at the statute, it is in no way an exercise of delegated legislative power. With the executive, I mean, if we accept that argument, I think essentially what that would mean is every time the executive branch executes a law that leaves it any ounce of discretion, essentially what it's doing is exercising a legislative power. And that would effectively mean that a legislative veto could be used to control, I think, virtually everything that the executive branch does. And we know that simply cannot be correct. That is not the result that any other state courts have reached when considering this very issue on constitutions both with explicit separation of powers clauses and constitutions with implicit separation of powers clauses. States across the country have recognized that this kind of veto over the core executive function of taking a statute that the legislature has passed and then applying it to individual circumstances is an executive function. It's as simple as that.
I don't necessarily, just one more
question.
One more follow up, really quick. Okay. I'm not disagreeing with you necessarily about the legislative logical extension of your argument into rulemaking. I'm not suggesting that the legislative veto is affecting, what I am suggesting is your argument, the logical extension of your argument, should have application with respect to rulemaking, which is not at issue in this case, but we can't slice and dice separation of powers. Either we're going to apply it strictly or we're not.
Well, I would argue even in the rulemaking context, I understand there. I think there is a dispute within the court over the nature of rulemaking. As Justice Hagedorn pointed out in the SEIU decision, there are two strands of doctrine within this court's decisions. Some of the earlier decisions take the position that rulemaking is an executive function. That position has changed as time has gone on. That's a dispute I think we can have in another case. This case, I think, is not a close call.
So how would you keep it narrow here? What would you ask us to hold so that we are not delving into an issue which is not before us? Maybe it's one of the issues we preserved when we took this case that we didn't take, but how would you keep it from affecting the rulemaking aspect?
Well, let me be clear. I do think that the rules we're asking for could have some implication in the rulemaking context. But the rule that I'm asking for on the executive power side, and Ms. Dealey will address by cameras, is that a legislative committee may not veto the executive's decisions in implementing a statutory program, including by spending appropriated money. Now, again, I will say to the respondents, I've not seen a single case anywhere in the country that blesses this kind of And I do want to address, I think, what their ultimate position is, which is essentially that what we're asking for is too big of a change in state government.
I just have a question that I want to ask, and this wasn't briefed by actually any of the parties, but it's interesting to me, is the question of remedy in this case. If you have a statutory structure, under your argument, that would say that giving the legislature the power to sort of veto particular purchases under this program is unconstitutional. Why would the remedy for that be then DNR gets to purchase whatever it wants? In other words, if the structure itself for purchasing anything over $250,000 is unconstitutional, isn't the answer there is no constitutional structure that authorizes those kinds of purchases? And so the remedy would be, you know, legislature and governor have to work together and come up with a new structure to spend that money because it does not exist. Again, assuming your argument is correct, I'm not sure why it would actually give the executive branch. It seems like we'd be rewriting the law potentially. I'd love to hear your response to that.
I take your Honor's question to essentially be one about severability.
Correct.
Are the veto provisions?
That's what INS versus Chadha talks about a little bit, though different argument context, but they do address severability.
And I would point you to Chadha, which did find the veto provision to be severable. And I would submit that most decisions to consider the severability question have found the veto provisions to be severable. Because what we're asking in severability context is two things. One, is the provision logically severable from the remaining statute? And in every single case of a legislative veto, the answer is yes. The veto provision simply says no. There is a full and complete and coherent statutory program that can proceed even without the negative that the legislative branch has given itself. So that's the logical side of the test. The second side of the test is legislative intent. And on that point, I would point this court to section WSSTAT 990.001 sub 11, which creates a statutory presumption of severability throughout the statutes. And so I think our default presumption in this case is that the legislature has said our statutes are severable. And that creates a significant burden on the side that wants to argue that they're not severable to point to some strong evidence of legislative intent that the provisions must rise and fall together. And again, I think the respondents, they haven't even argued severability here. I think they concede that these are severable.
Typically, we really try to adhere to the red light. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley would like to ask a brief question.
Yes, thank you. Your position seems to be black and white. Once the legislature has passed the bill, hands off, isn't there any nuance to the position, some kind of limitation on your black and white argument? It seems to me there should be some that limits your argument in certain circumstances.
I think the problem, Your Honor, is that there's no source in the constitutional text for a limiting principle of the kind Your Honor is searching for. I think when our drafters framed the Constitution, they did more or less create a black and white world, which is that the legislature, when it passes a law, especially one like Knowles-Nelson, it's then the executive's job to carry it out. I think if you try to start searching for a limiting principle that has no support in the constitutional text, you're in very dangerous waters, because I think as we found with these veto provisions is you give the legislature an inch and they take a mile. Any limiting principle, they will push as far as they can. As you've seen today, there are over 100 JCF veto provisions alone, and that doesn't count other committees like the Joint Committee on Employment Relations, which, as Your Honors well know, vetoed the UW pay raises just last fall. So this is a big problem, and I think when you start trying to draw those lines without any support in the constitutional text, you run into serious problems.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Gathering Waters and its members have been increasingly affected by the veto authorities before this Court today. With our limited time, we plan to discuss the anti-democratic functioning of JCF vis-a-vis the procedural requirements of bicameralism and presentment. It is a basic tenet.
So, make sure you speak up or pull the microphone a little closer, if you would, please.
Yes. Thank you, Justice.
Because what you say is so important, we all want to hear it.
It is a basic tenet of our Constitution that the whole of our legislature is greater than the sum of its parts. For good reason. Individual legislators cannot claim to represent the state in its entirety. Those elected to our assembly represent 1.01% of the Wisconsin population, and those elected to the Senate represent 3.03% of the population, approximately.
Counsel, given the limited time, I apologize. I just want to jump right into a question that I have about this bicameralism and presentment argument. I understand what your co-counsel argued in terms of the core power argument. I'm having a little bit more difficult time understanding this bicameralism and presentment argument, and I wonder if maybe you could help me out with it. It seems to me that the core of the argument is something along the lines of the legislature is modifying the law without going through the constitutional process for modifying the law, namely passing a bill in both houses and presenting it to governor. But the law has already been enacted, and the law is, structured in such a way that it requires the legislature or the committee to approve any given expenditures over that certain amount. And so in that sense, I don't understand the argument that it's modifying the laws. It's quite different than, Chadha, which had, you know, the executive branch, you know, action could be carried out, and then you have sort of a selective reversal of it after the fact. And this is a very different kind of structure. Here it seems like the structure is you cannot spend money for these purchases over $250,000 unless you have this approval. So I don't understand the argument that it's modifying the law. It just doesn't, it seems like it's almost a backwards analysis. The other case I'm aware of where we've touched on this kind of thing is Martinez, which arose in a very different sort of context. Because bicameralism presentment is the means by which the Constitution prescribes laws. That's how the laws become enacted. I don't understand how it plays into this.
Your Honor, we think the veto that was considered in Chadha is very instructive here. And that is because this statutory scheme, essentially, the legislature has created the authorization in statute, but then it's reserved the right to eliminate that authorization through something other than legislation. And that's precisely what happened in Chadha. Your second point, which I take to be whether the fact that the initial veto mechanism went through bicameralism and presentment, whether that's curative, and it is not. The legislature cannot use bicameralism and presentment to get out of having to use bicameralism and presentment for future lawmaking and future exertions of its will on the governed. This was mentioned by the Alaska Supreme Court in State v. Alive Voluntary. They said, in other words, by virtue of one enactment approved by the governor, the legislature can free itself in certain circumstances of the constitutional constraints that would otherwise govern its actions. So the fact that the creation of this veto went through bicameralism and presentment doesn't insulate it from consideration of whether, when those veto authorities are used, whether they pose a constitutional problem.
So I just want to follow up to...
Go ahead, Justice Prosewitz. I'll follow up after
you. Thank you. I just want to follow up to Justice Hagedorn's question. So we have Martinez, right? How do you factor Martinez into the bicameralism and presentment argument? Can we distinguish it? Do we have to overrule it? What's your position?
I think this court can distinguish it. That was the position we took. Gathering Waters members are NCOs who entered this case after this court chose to hold certain issues in abeyance. It has a particular and unique stake in the Joint Committee on Finance's veto authority over the Knowles-Nelson program, and not the rulemaking authorities exercised by the agencies and reviewed by JCRER. We think it's distinguishable on the rulemaking points. And also, in some ways, it's consistent with Martinez insofar as the court in Martinez, as this court reiterated in SEIU, did require the sustaining of that veto, the exercise of that veto, to go through a bicameralism and presentment. That being said, the position that we're advocating for today doesn't contemplate a delayed exercise of bicameralism and presentment. It is our view that the bicameralism and presentment requirements are not met if they come after the fact of the legislative act.
I want to ask you a question, and I think this is important for the bicameralism and presentment, at least in my mind, and you may have answered it in response to Justice Hagedorn's question, but I just want to make sure that it's clear in my mind. What is it about this particular action that constitutes lawmaking? And this is why it's kind of a hot bench up here if you haven't noticed, so I'm going to throw just a couple more just to put this in context of the, just saying.
Okay, kind of hot. Probably true.
Yeah. I want to know, like, how you would distinguish it from other decisions that the Joint Finance Committee makes. And I'm just going to throw one last question out here, and I'll repeat these. Yeah, I know. You're not going to write them down. So the Joint Finance Committee, they've got like 120 separate approval or veto powers. I'm also interested to know, if we apply the rule that you're asking us to apply today, how it is going to impact the rest of the approval and veto powers that the Joint Committee on Finance has. I can repeat any of those if you'd like. Thank you.
The veto making, or rather the veto authority, is distinctly different from the authority we tend to attach to the to committee action, right? It is entirely appropriate, almost required and expected that committees perform auditing functions, investigatory functions, support the lawmaking process, do those things that are adjunct to the lawmaking process. So committees play an essential role to the lawmaking process.
This isn't the only time that the Joint Finance Committee has veto authority, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so are you about to say that if we rule the way that you are asking us to rule, that it would impact any of the veto powers that the Joint Committee on Finance has?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it would be a lost cause to try to argue that our position wouldn't have significant impacts on the functioning of committees that exercise veto authorities. Because it is our position that any time the legislature, through committee, and in this case, through individual legislators who are able to exercise an objection mechanism that can hold a decision in abeyance indefinitely, that functions as a withdrawal of authority from the executive. So that theory, that principle, absolutely would apply to other committee veto authorities. And the proliferation of these mechanisms, I think, warrants the courts speaking to them. It's because there's been this increased reliance on these mechanisms, which are unconstitutional and which do not go through the proper procedural requirements, that counsels the court to interject now and pronounce that they're unconstitutional.
And so what is it about this that is lawmaking? Like how would, if you were going to write this opinion, what would it say exactly? Right? This is a lawmaking function because...
I would recommend the court look to Chadha. The Chadha court, they started with this initial question of, is it legislative in purpose and effect?
Can you just give a statement, an assertion in answer to the question, then explain why your assertion is...
Yes, Your Honor. I think the most straightforward and easy to apply rule in the context of this veto is that a repeal or an amendment to powers already previously conferred, that constitutes exercise of the law, exercise of the lawmaking powers, and should be invalidated.
But how? Oh, are you going to follow up? But how is that different than what I'm going to ask your question, Justice.
Thank you, Justice.
You're welcome. how is that different than the points Justice Rebecca Bradley was making when she was asking Mr. Roth about the non-delegation power? That's what you just said seems kind of broad.
It's for one key procedural difference, which is, well, actually a couple. first, the bicameralism and presentment requirements are procedural mechanisms that attach and apply to the legislature. The legislature is a body that acts collectively because it is made up of individual representatives that do not represent the state. On the other hand,
administrative agency personnel do not represent the people. They've been elected by no one. So I'm having a hard time understanding the logic of your argument where you're asking us to curtail legislative power in this one context, but rulemaking's okay. In other words, it's the same question I asked Mr. Roth. Why is it okay for the executive to exercise legislative power? We said in Koshki when administrative agencies promulgate rules, they are exercising legislative power that the legislature has chosen to delegate them by statute. That's what the legislature has done in this context as well. It's delegated its legislative power to a committee. So how can we have a holding that is limited to the legislative veto power, and it doesn't extend to the administrative state? The arguments you're making apply with greater force in the administrative agency context.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I have to disagree that there's an absence of checks on the executive branch. The executive branch is...
It's not about checks. It's about what the people, when they ratified the Constitution, it's what the people gave to their elected officials. Elected officials can't exercise power that the people never gave them under the Constitution. You agree with that, right?
I absolutely agree with that, Your Honor.
And there's nothing in the Constitution that sanctions the administrative state. There's nothing in the Constitution that says, hey, legislature, you can give your power away to the executive branch, or God forbid, the judicial branch.
To your point, Your Honor, the legislature specifically, under the terms of our Constitution, is subject to the procedural requirements of bicameralism and presentment. The lawmaking process was intentionally difficult, burdensome, by design. That is, the process is the check on the legislative system and the legislative branch. On the other hand, the bicameralism and presentment, my red light is on, may I finish? And this is discussed in depth in Note 16 in the Chadha decision. I think precisely the point that you are discussing, Your Honor. The executive branch, on the other hand, is not or is checked by things that the legislature is not. The terms of legislation, the judicial branch, which can review the executive branch's exercise and administration of the law, and they can't, the Joint Committee on Finance. Impeachment, executive branch officials are subject to the control of the governor statewide, and then, of course, at the back end, new lawmaking to change the terms of the authority granted to the executive. And that is the reason why bicameralism and presentment is a requirement for the legislative branch, and it does not affix to the executive.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. Misha Zaitlin for the legislature and the respondents. You just heard from my friends. They would have this court overturn how our state government has functioned for almost a century, ever since the beginning of the modern administrative state. Since at least 1929, legislative committees or legislative-dominated boards have reduced appropriations, increased appropriations, vetoed building projects, and have, as in the circumstance here, approved expenditures. My friends, despite being given multiple opportunities by multiple justices of this court, were not willing or able to offer any limiting principle whatsoever to the revolution they would have this court unleash in this original action.
Counsel, one of the problems that I see here is, you know, maybe this is a little bit of a fork in the road, maybe it's not, depends how we decide this case, but these things have happened, I agree with you, but we have not generally blessed those things, other than Martinez and Ahern, maybe. And there's some more, there's other areas where we've done some of that, but the sort of vigorous role given to committees here is something new that this court hasn't addressed quite in this capacity. You know, Chadha said, hey, you've been doing this for 50 years too, and, you know, that's necessarily going to impact what we do here. The problem, you know, I have is it feels like this is a case that's asking us to go back to first principles. And maybe the answer is we shouldn't. Maybe the answer is we should just say this is the way it's always happened, or this is how the court, you know, blessed certain types of things that are related in the mid to late 20th century, and we should just run with those things. But you don't really make an argument about the original meaning of the Constitution here in terms of what executive power is. And I'd like you to either, if you're not trying to make that argument, that's fine. I didn't see it in your briefs, but do you have anything related to kind of the original constitutional design, text, structure, history that supports your position, at least as it relates to, you know, the fact that this would be the legislature exercising executive power?
Well, Your Honor, I will talk in a second about whether this is a core power or a shared power under this court's doctrine. But with regard to originalism, I think it's fair to say that the modern administrative state was not envisioned by the founders, and what these provisions have developed both at the federal level and in Wisconsin is a response, a practical response to the administrative state. Certainly there is a credible argument, as Justice Bradley has articulated both here and in prior opinions, that the modern administrative state has very serious problems under one view of the original public meaning of the Constitution. But once we're past that bridge, you can't have a wooden, hermetically sealed separation of powers that only benefits one branch. If the court, and it has since the 1920s, the beginning of the administrative state, has blessed the legislature giving over some of its legislative power to the executive branch in view of the realities of modern governance, you then can't take away the practical tools that the legislative branch needs to really interact with
this kind of... Are these tools really practical? I mean, let me just go through a series of questions I have about this program specifically, okay? Like, could the Joint Committee on Finance hold a Knowles-Nelson proposal in abeyance in perpetuity?
It could deny it, or it could...
Forever, right? Right? And are they, is the Joint Committee on Finance, are they obligated to consider any statutorily recognized interest in land conservation when they do that?
They are not required, but I will...
Let me just ask a couple more questions, and then you can rebut me for the rest of your time if you'd like. are they required to articulate a reason, any reasoning, or are they required to issue a decision when they exercise their veto power?
No.
Is it appealable or reviewable?
No.
So I don't understand what processes, what procedures, what policy determinations the Joint Committee on Finance needs to make in order to veto a proposal. I mean, there doesn't seem to me to be any limits whatsoever. There are zero guardrails here.
Well, Your Honor, there's no, I think, gainsaying that this is exactly how legislative review committee provisions or boards have worked for the last century. And with regard to the practicalities of how the GFC...
Well, maybe they've been wrong for the last century, and we shouldn't, like, double down on how wrong this is. There is zero accountability. Though the legal scholars, starting on page 12 of their brief, just articulate over and over, you know, page 12, that the legislature must maintain journals, keep its doors open to the public. A majority of the legislatures must be present to do business. The Joint Finance Committee consists of 16 people out of 132 who are in the legislature. 75% of those are from one party. They have a quorum with only 5 people, and it only takes one person to veto. I don't see any accountability whatsoever.
Well, I don't think those one person to veto is correct. All it takes is the committee, once the pass review process is triggered, the committee votes a majority. But I will say this, to the extent Your Honor is concerned about how GFC operates as a practical matter, and I think that, you know, the separation of powers, share power analysis involves a real inquiry like that, I think this case is not...
Well, tell us how the one person anonymous committee veto works.
There's no one person anonymous committee evidence in the record. The only thing that Gathering Waters points to is the letters that are sent to DNR that says that there's been an objection raised to this. We're going to do what the statute provides. And I think this is a fundamental problem with the posture that we're in here. We've had absolutely no ability to do any sort of factual development as to how GFC functions. You know, we have a case that followed on from SCIU with regard to the settlement provisions. And it was an as-applied challenge that was then brought. It was filed in Dane County Circuit Court. There was factual development in that case, and we have a robust record of how GFC in fact functions.
But why do we need factual development when the principle you're giving us is that if any arm of government wanted to spend, let's say, more than $5, the legislature could require the approval of, here it's JCF, it could be just Robin Voss. Under what you're arguing to us, isn't it true that you would say that if any arm of government wanted to spend more than $5, they would need the approval of Robin Voss? And that would be constitutional.
The argument that we're making is, in this facial challenge, there are at least some spending decisions that implicate the legislature's core functions. It's the same argument we made in SEIU.
Okay, and what I just said to you was implicating spending. So tell me how that is unconstitutional under what you're arguing.
So,
my hypothetical.
So I think in order to answer that question, I need to discuss how what's happening here fits into the core powers framework and the shared powers framework, so if I may.
Go ahead.
So this court has held from Martinez and so on and further into the SEIU that you look at a claim power as either a core power, in which case it's a no-go for other branches, or a shared power. Here, what power do we have here? We have the power to decide whether the state is going to purchase a piece of land or a piece of property. That is in no circumstance a core executive power, and I can prove it in the following way. If the legislature tomorrow enacted a statute that said, DNR, you must purchase a 220-acre tract near Devil's Lake State Park, the DNR would have to do it, and that decision to purchase that would not involve any sort of executive function whatsoever. Since the decision to make a purchasing decision can be made without any executive leeway, it follows that that's not a core executive function. It might be a shared power, in which case then we move on. Sorry, Your Honor, as you're shaking your head.
It's okay. I'm not understanding. It's only a shared power if some discretion is given to the executive agency. You're saying it no longer is a core power if no discretion is given to the agency, even though the agency is the one executing it.
No.
So you're basically, what I hear you saying is that's how you're dividing it up. I get that the legislature can take away discretion. Of course they could. But if there's discretion to spend the money, how is it not the executive that has the power to execute the law that's been passed?
Your Honor, I guess I didn't. Let me try it one more time. The question is the power being exercised here a core power? The power to decide whether to purchase a particular tract of land. I am saying it is not, it cannot possibly be a core power because that decision could be made entirely by the legislature.
Because it could be, it's no longer a core power for the executive agency to execute the law.
The decision, I mean, that's a high-level principle. The decision here is...
Who's the, in your wow. hypothetical, no, I didn't quite track. In your hypothetical, who is deciding to buy the tract of land by Devil's Lake? Is it the DNR?
No, it would be legislature enacting a standalone statute that said buy the tract of land.
Okay, so the statute says DNR, this is what you are to do.
And then DOA would cut the check and the land would be bought. So the okay. execution in that circumstance would just be to execute the thing. Since...
Oh, wait, he's yeah. saying I just want to make sure I'm totally understanding. Are you saying then that is the legislature exercising its core power or is there a shared...
In that circumstance, the legislature would be exercising its core power.
Yeah, okay.
Now, since the legislature can make that decision on its own, it follows that making that decision can't be so core to the executive that it's one of the rare things that is a core power. Instead, it is... Sorry, Your Honor.
Okay, so just because they actually made the law that says that the executive should go by the land... You're saying that, therefore, the executive going out and purchasing the land is not executing their core power because the legislature passed that law? Aren't they still actually executing the law? The law didn't leave discretion, but they're executing it.
The actual purchasing of the land,
is execution.
Cutting the check, is executive. The decision whether to purchase a piece of land is something the legislature has the power to make on its own. And because it has the power to make that decision on its own, it must be a shared power. Because if something is a core power, then the legislature couldn't do it on its own.
So when is it executive power? What is executive power? What's core executive power under your scenario?
Making the actual purchase, cutting the check from DOA, going and contracting.
So in your mind, do the executive agencies have discretion? Mm.
They have the amount of discretion that is given to them by the statutes. And when the statutes give the agency a discretion as to whether to make a public policy decision as to whether to purchase a major piece of land, that is the legislature giving some of its authority to the executive branch.
So what is that then?
That's its legislative authority is being given to the executive branch, which this court has blessed since the 1920s. Contrary to my friend's argument, that's not them giving the executive power to the executive branch. That's legislators saying, we have the legislative authority, our constitutional authority, to decide whether this big piece of land is going to be bought. We are giving you, DNR, some of our power to make that decision in light of the realities of modern governments.
And when the deal, so can, let me give you an example. Let's just say this tract of land that's by Devil's Lake. Let's say the tract of land that's by Devil's Lake.
Yes.
Let's say that the statute that the legislature passed says you're to buy this tract of land and you're to pay, I'm just going to throw out a number, it's going to be low, but you're to pay no more than $100,000 for the tract of land.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that gives the DNR some discretion, right? They can spend up to $100,000? Correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So what is that power that the DNR has at that moment?
I mean, I think probably the fairest way to say that would be in the great borderlands that where most powers reside. Now, certainly, I think that would be closer.
Is that like a penumbra? What's the great borderlands?
I mean, Your Honor, it's easy to say that glibly, but that's literally from this quotes from Martinez, from SEIU. I mean, that's the
score. Yeah, here's my problem with Martinez and SEIU. Okay. I mean, even SEIU said that, talking about Martinez, neither of them dealt with an endless suspension of rules. And I asked you, one of the first questions I asked you was, could one of these vetoes stop a project in perpetuity? And you said, yeah, it could. And Martinez, that was not an endless suspension of the rules. And SEIU was not something that was going to go on forever. This is different. So tell me why those cases would apply here.
I certainly agree that that aspect of Martinez is not, I mean, that's one of the questions this court reserved. Martinez, however, favorably cited Ahern, which, you know, the building was never going to be built if the building commission didn't agree with the governor. So that's...
Let's put Ahern over
okay,
there.
Okay, and then with the SEIU, certainly Your Honor is correct with regard to the Martinez-esque provisions of JCRAR, but with regard to the litigation provisions, if the JFC didn't agree with the Attorney General on a settlement, that settlement was not going to happen. So the structure there is similar. And what this court said in SEIU, and I know some of the justices of this court did not agree with that, what the court said in SEIU was that because the power of the purse is implicated, then the legislature could have a seat at the table. And one of the criticisms the dissent made of even that decision, well, there was no dollar amount. Well, here one of the, like other states have. Well, here, at least for one of the two provisions here, we have a $250K dollar amount, which I think would address some of the dissent's concerns from SEIU. Further, in SEIU, even the dissent didn't say that the legislative review provisions of the settlements were unconstitutional. What it said, is what Your Honor said, was it needs to go back to the circuit court to develop facts, the kind of facts that we have developed in the Call case about the practical operations.
Right, but this is a facial challenge. So
yeah.
We don't need to develop facts. The whole idea is, it could be as simple as, which I know you didn't answer my question, as really just the ability for any arm of government, if they wanted to spend more than $5, that in your mind, the legislature could say, you can't do that unless you have the approval of, name anybody, name one legislator, name a committee. But basically, that's what you're saying.
Your Honor, I think it's fair to say that both sides have a problem with limiting principles. I think you heard it.
Both sides have what?
A problem with ability principles. To offer this court a limiting principle.
Yes.
So what I would say is the caution. So what I would say to the court is the principle this court should follow is a caution principle. What we are arguing for has been how the state government has operated since the advent of the administrative state almost a century ago. What they're advocating for is brand new. They're relying upon CHATA. We put in front of Your Honors what has happened at the federal level since CHATA. The Congressional Research Service has said the Congress has basically ignored CHATA. 80% of legislative review provisions have been enacted since CHATA. At the federal level.
Counsel, it seems to me that your argument, if we accept it, would enshrine the idea that we really do not have much of a separation of powers, that we should look at this pragmatically and functionally, that we should accept the idea that drawing lines between the powers is not really something we're interested in doing, other than to ensure that the power isn't unchecked. In other words, we don't care about separation of powers so much as more balance of powers. In some, it is true, that is the way, to some extent, Ahern and Martinez and some others talk about That's not the way that some members of this court have talked about it recently. That's not the way that the court talked about it during the first, 80, 90, 100 years or so of our existence. And so am I right that that's what you're asking us to sort of enshrine?
I mean, I don't think we're going that far. I think my point, my modest point, these are very difficult issues. Obviously, I find Justice White's dissent in Chadha more persuasive than the majority, but people could differ. But they are the ones coming in here asking this court to fundamentally change our state government. Therefore, it is their obligation to give you guys something that you can work with. Not the answers that we got here today is no limiting principle, no limiting principle, no limiting
Mr.
principle,
Saitlin,
no
I'm
limiting
the, principle. On the notion that this... So I just have a very quick question. Part of your argument is that what your friends on the other side are asking us to do is novel, is big, is this big, big shift. But the legal scholars in their brief said that no state court has upheld a scheme of committee-based governance like Wisconsin's. My question to you is, do you know of any state court that has in fact upheld a scheme such as this? Because in the research that I looked at and the research that we did in looking at other cases around the country, I had a hard time finding a state court that did what you are asking us to do. It is true that legislatures across the country are giving themselves this type of power, but I don't know of a case that has come out the way that you are asking us to come out here.
I mean, Ahern from
this group. I'm putting Ahern over here for today.
I think Idaho and Vermont have come the closest, but I will grant my friends that the significant majority of the cases come out their direction. But I would respect.
So it's not really a sea change.
No. Here's the fundamental difference, Your Honor, and I think practicalities matter. The only kind of empirical research we have on how this works is at the federal level. And we know at the federal level, Chadha completely failed. 80%, I'm going to repeat that again, 80% of the legislative review provisions at the federal level were enacted after Chadha. The only reason the federal government has not fundamentally changed because after Chadha is that there is no taxpayer standing at the federal level. Therefore, the government of the United States functions just as it did before, even more reliance on legislative joint committee review or committee
Council,
review.
In, part of the problem,
if I,
though,
if
is...
I just,
I'm sorry, go
sorry,
ahead.
If I just
go
could
ahead,
finish. Yeah. In Wisconsin, unlike at the federal level, there is taxpayer standing. What's going to happen if Your Honor adopted a position is all these provisions under their no-limit principle are going to get struck down. There is nothing in front of Your Honors in this very... with respect, rush posture, for this court to know what exactly will happen to our state government if that is unleashed. What we know is the one empirical study we have at the federal level, it didn't work, since the Congress continued to do it even more after Chadha. I can't tell you exactly what will happen, but this court has no reason to have confidence that it won't be a significant problem that hasn't been fully, honestly, with candor, put fully
before
counsel, the court.
Okay, counsel, I just want to follow up on Justice Karofsky's question in regard to the legal scholar's brief. Legal scholar's brief on page 15 states, more than 20 state courts have considered challenges to legislative vetoes, and they have rejected them with virtual unanimity. Is there any state, and I think that's the question Justice Karofsky was asking you, is there any state that approves a scheme like we have here in the state of Wisconsin? Anywhere.
Idaho, I think the Mead case from Idaho explicitly adopts Justice White's dissent from Chadha. I think my friends will not be able to say that under the dissent from Chadha, what was going on here is impermissible. And then Justice White later brought forward that dissent in Boucher. So, I mean, the Idaho Supreme Court didn't face this particular scheme, but since they adopted, it quoted at length Justice White's.
It sounds like the answer is no. And did all those states where they answered yes, did their state governments crumble like you're telling us is going to happen here?
Your Honor, I don't know what has happened on the ground. We had 20 days to respond to the brief in this case. The only empirical study we were able to find is what happened at the federal government. And it's striking. It's striking that after Chadha, which kind of launched this whole revolution, the Supreme Court 8-1, the decision was, I think that's what probably motivated a lot of these decisions to come out the way they did. It didn't work at the federal level. This is not speculation. 80%, you know, when you read Chadha, it's really striking. Justice White talks about there's 200, 300 of these committee review provisions, and he warns, what's going to happen if you get rid of these? So what happened is the Congress doubled down. And if you read the Congressional Research Report that we cited in our brief, they say that most of the review provisions that Congress has enacted after Chadha have been exactly like this one, have been in the appropriation context where certain monies can't be spent until the appropriation committees approve it.
I'm surprised to hear you argue that we should look at the practicalities and the policy decisions as opposed to looking at our Constitution. That sounds to me like, well, that's what you're arguing here, is that we shouldn't do this because it could have some real impacts on how government works.
My point on the Constitution...
Despite the Constitution.
Not despite the Constitution. What I responded to, Justice Hagedorn, if this court wants to go to a kind of a hermetically sealed wooden view of the separation of powers, which is certainly something that can be done, then you can't just do it for the executive branch. You have to bring back the non-delegation doctrine. You can't allow what Justice White talked about in his Chadha dissent, which is putting the legislature into a Hobson's choice, where either it has to prescriptively set out in particular detail every single, for example, here, every single piece of land that's going to be brought, or unleash unilateral executivism.
Or how about the legislature just pass laws and let the executive execute them? And actually, if they give the executive discretion, let the executive have it. And if they don't want the executive to have discretion, don't give it to them.
Yeah,
I don't see the Hobson's choice. This is how government has worked since the beginning of time.
Government since the administrative state, rise of the administrative state in the 1920s, has worked with a joint committee review provision in the state of Wisconsin. There has been no time where what they are asking this court to unleash has been the case in Wisconsin, which is a large administrative state with no effective check through a committee review provision. It's never happened.
Counsel, a couple of things. One is not a lot of reference to Wisconsin as the administrative state. When these students leave, they'll go past the portrait of Marvin Rosenberry, who is considered the father of the administrative state in the country. He's the one that started it. That aside, you speak of your opponents as having a position that's hermetically sealed. I need your help. I think yours is hermetically sealed, too, and I am searching for some kind of limitation, some kind of limiting principle. As I understand your argument, the power of the purse given to the legislature makes it always a shared power when you are addressing spending appropriated money. Is that your position? And if so, that seems like just as hermetically sealed as your opponent.
Your Honor, as I candidly admitted earlier, both parties are unable to offer this court any great limiting principles.
You're talented. You're smart. Come on up.
I mean, look, my mom says those things about me, but I'm not smarter than Justice White, who himself, you know, what he said is, given the realities of modern government, these committee review provisions are a practical way to avoid the Hobson's choice that otherwise legislature would face. I mean, it's not, you know, Justice Hagedorn talked about severability. Yeah, sure, this is severable. But what happens is Noel Snelson is going to expire in 2026. Legislature is not going to reauthorize giving the DNR a blank check to spend $30 million or within the $6 million bites. The legislature is going to have to enact specific laws saying, buy this tract in Devil's Lake. Do that. And that won't, I don't think that's going to benefit anyone. I don't think Gathering Waters would be too happy about that. But maybe that's a feature of having a hermetically sealed separation of powers.
Is that kind of the point, though? I mean, the point of holding the branches to their lines, at least in some capacity, on a principled basis in the Constitution, is that it requires the legislature to govern. And it requires the legislature perhaps to not give so much authority because it won't want to if it can't claw it back. So I'm not sure it's a one-way ratchet in any particular direction. I mean, I think you're right. the legislature pretty clearly doesn't want the executive branch to have broad authority to spend on whatever it wants, over $250,000. And the answer is it won't give it if it doesn't have that. And so there's going to have to be some governing according to the process of enacting laws and executing laws. Isn't that kind of what the Constitution envisions?
I am not saying that the hermetically sealed vision of the separation of powers is somehow unreasonable, or that people of you know, smarter people than me can't support it. What I'm saying is I would urge this court to just be careful. The state of Wisconsin government has functioned a certain way for a long time. We've got a very rushed briefing schedule here. We have a limited development. The only case study we have is what's happened at the federal level, and CHATA has just failed completely at the federal level.
So why shouldn't our court hold this decision in abeyance until we can hear out all these other issues to make sure we are consistent with the way we're deciding these things, or give the parties the opportunity to brief the administrative state issues so we are sure we aren't missing something when it comes to treating all three branches the same with respect to their power and authority?
I think that would be wise. You know, I think it would also, you know, that would allow the parties more time to develop what's really gone on the ground in other states. Again, we only know what's happened at the federal level. That's all we have before, Your Honors. And I mean, it's striking. I mean, before I learned about this stuff, you know, before SEIU and then this, I did not know that CHATA was a dead letter at the federal level. I thought there were no legislative vetoes at the federal level. Now I've learned that 80% of legislative vetoes have been enacted since CHATA, and apparently most of them have been in exactly this kind of context, where the appropriators don't want to give a blank check to the executive branch at the federal level, and so they're having joint review provisions. You know, I think this court, and then obviously a lot of the justices of this court are looking for limiting principles. I think it's fair to say that neither side has offered you all any. Maybe that supplemental briefing could offer that principle. The other option this court could have, if Your Honors are not comfortable with the lack of limiting principles from the other side, is dismiss the petition as improvidently granted, allow them, my friends, to refile in the circuit court, which is the way these things should normally happen, develop more record, have opinions from thoughtful judges.
For a facially constitutional challenge, you want us to send it back to develop the record?
Your Honor, with respect to SIU, you were saying that it should be sent back to the, in your dissent, that it should, that the...
I'm talking about this case.
I mean, that was a facial challenge to committee review. You know, I mean, and so, and that's, you know, Martinez's official challenge started in the circuit court. I mean, that's generally how it's done. I mean, but I understand that, you know, that these issues that are of such importance is attractive to decide them in an original action posture, but it has been limited in the time that we had and the words that we have to brief and decide a case that will revolutionize the way our government has functioned for a century.
So Justice Ann Walsh Bradley wanted to ask a question before. Now Justice Rebecca Bradley would like a little latitude. So go ahead and answer the question she presents as well.
It's a simple question. Would the legislature welcome a restoration of original principles with respect to the separation of powers applied across each branch of government in this decision? In other words, I understand your argument to be, look, this has been the law in Wisconsin for decades. Both branches have respected this regime and acted under it. And now you're kind of pulling the rug out from under us. We gave you all this discretion, understanding that we retained the check of the legislative veto. Now you're asking for the removal of that legislative veto or the invalidation of it. So if you want that, then executive, we're going to claw back the legislative power that you have perhaps been unconstitutionally exercising as blessed by this court decades ago.
I think as a matter of respect to co-equal branches, the same type of inquiry needs to be applied to both the executive and the legislative branch. If this court is going to do a more formalist approach like CHATA, you know, then it should think about what that formalist approach means for the non-delegation doctrine.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And rebuttal.
Mr. Roth, while you're getting settled, Mr. Sadlin, your friend on the other side, talked about this 80% of legislative vetoes haven't been enacted since CHATA. Can you respond to that? And more broadly, can you respond to the notion that if we find in your favor here,
state government as we know it is going to change so dramatically we won't even recognize it?
Yes, Your Honor. The first thing I'd say is I think the fact that Congress has ignored CHATA is simply a sign of how tempting this power is and how much it really takes out the legislature from exercising this kind of veto authority. I think that's a point against them. I don't think that's a point in their favor. Now, in terms of the practical results, I think it's critical to recognize the legislative branch retains very, very significant tools to, if it wants, rein in the executive branch and executive agencies, even without the veto. And I'll address five of them, I think, that are the most important. The most important of all is the appropriations power. Every 2 years, the executive agencies have to come to the legislature hat in hand asking for more money. And if the legislative branch doesn't like what DNR has done over the past 2 years with Knowles Nelson or anything else, it might have a difficult time getting the money it wants. Two, the legislature can amend or narrow the statutes that it's enacted. I think if you look at the federal level, and I would commend to you the Curtis Bradley article that's cited in the Gathering Waters material, it observes that Congress, in fact, did ratchet back a number of the statutes, including the one at issue in CHATA. It narrowed the scope of the executive discretion to make the deportation decisions that were at issue. I think that's a very perfect case study in what exactly should happen. Third, the legislature can enact sunset provisions in programs, just like it's done with Knowles Nelson. Four, legislative oversight and audits. It can demand testimony from executive branch agencies. It can audit DNR. It's never done that. We have allegations of mismanagement of the program. Well, where's the audit? Where's the oversight? It's just they've never done it. Fifth, you can reject agency secretary heads. I think with those five tools combined, you'll see that the legislative branch retains substantial amounts of control such that it does not need the veto.
There's another tool at the legislature's disposal. The legislature could basically repeal every act that facilitates the administrative state. My question for you is, would Governor Evers welcome a restoration of the original understanding of the separation of powers in the state of Wisconsin and welcome the repeal of executive agencies making law?
Well, again, Your Honor, I disagree with the premise that the executive agencies are making the law. Governor Evers obviously takes the position that his executive agencies are doing a good job in executing the law. So I disagree with the premise
rule
of your question.
Rulemaking is making law. We've said that repeatedly.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think that's a question for another day. I would like to turn just very briefly to the...
Are you asking us to overturn our jurisprudence saying that rulemaking is lawmaking?
We will, but not in this case. The court has not taken up that issue,
Thanks
Your Honor.
Thanks for the forewarning.
Of course. I'd like to very briefly...
Why shouldn't we hold this case in abeyance to make sure that we are dealing with each of these issues and powers that are due to each of the branches of government at the same time?
This
Instead
issue...
of granting more power potentially here and then giving more power through the administrative state question later. I'm hearing you say that's what you're asking for. Power for the governor here... Power for the executive later.
We ask this court to take up the rulemaking issue, and we would encourage it to do so. That's how I would answer that question.
So how about holding this case in abeyance, take up that issue, get the parties to fully brief and argue it, and decide it all in one case? Why wouldn't that make
they are
sense?
They are logically independent. This case is about implementing state law, not about rulemaking. I'd like
but
to very briefly...
What's the rush with this case? Why rush this case as it's been
Because the
rushed?
JCF vetoes are imposing a significant burden on the executive branch. As we pointed out in our petition, one-third of Knowles Nelson projects over the past 5 years have been vetoed by JCF. Joker canceled the UW pay raises. This is a big problem today. We cannot wait for a decision. I'd like to very briefly turn to the bicameralism and presentment test, which a number of justices asked about. I would point, Your Honors, to the Justice Antonin Scalia article. I was surprised to see this cited in the Gathering Waters brief. He was an ardent opponent of the legislative veto. And as he articulated, the reason this triggers the lawmaking requirement is, he says, quote, the withdrawal of executive power previously conferred, that is to say, the prohibition of executive action, which is currently legitimate, can only be done by law, that is, by that process which invokes the presidential veto power. I don't want to get bogged down on that. I encourage you to review that article by Scalia. I was surprised to see that myself when I read it.
I wasn't counsel.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I'd like to briefly address the historical arguments that my friend made. I just don't think it's correct to say this is a century-old system of vetoes. They've identified one veto provision from 1929 that affected, I believe, DOC's predecessor ability to build state buildings. These veto provisions, as the legislative scholars very aptly show, started emerging in the 1970s and the 1980s. The administrative state existed well before then. This was not a new issue, the idea of the legislative branch granting discretion to the executive. That's the fundamental flaw in their theory, as you heard them articulate it. Any time a statute grants discretion to the executive branch, the legislature gets to control that exercise of discretion. I'd encourage you to think what that means for DAs, for instance. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Interesting oral arguments. We are adjourned in this case. The court will next convene for bar admissions. Right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.